Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. We will continue listening to Tenjin's previous program with the book Mind Trainings Like the Rays of Sun by Lam Kapow. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program where we are talking about gossip. Let's start with a story about Socrates, the great Greek philosopher. It goes like this. In ancient Greek, that's 469 to 399 BC, Socrates was widely lauded for his wisdom. One day, the great philosopher came upon an acquaintance who ran up to him excitedly and said, "Socrates, do you know what I just heard about one of your students?" "Wait a moment," Socrates replied. "Before you tell me, I'd like you to pass a little test. It's called the Test of the Three." "Test of the Three?" "That's correct," Socrates continued. "Before you talk to me about my student, let's take a moment to test what you're going to say. The first test is truth. Have you made absolutely sure that what you're about to tell me is true?" No, the man replied. "Actually, I just heard about it." "All right," said Socrates. "So you don't really know if it's true or not. Now let's try the second test, the test of goodness. Is what you're about to tell me about my student something good?" "No, on the contrary." "So," Socrates continued, "you want to tell me something bad about him, even though you're not certain it's true." The man shrugged, a little embarrassed. Socrates continued, "You may still pass, though, because there is a third test, the filter of usefulness. Is what you want to tell me about my student going to be useful to me?" "No, not really." "Well," concluded Socrates, "if what you want to tell me is neither true, nor good, nor even useful, why tell it to me at all?" The man was defeated and ashamed and said no more. There are many variations of this story, and this is one of two taken from the page Wisdom Stories to Live By on philipchirkop.wordpress.com. Now, wouldn't it be great if we never spoke anything about anyone else that was not true, good, or kind, or useful or necessary? Now there's a good resolution to take and keep. Last time, in discussing the slogan "Don't Malign Others" from Lam Kapow's Mind Training Like the Rays of the Sun, we spoke a little about the dangers of gossip. And gossip is especially dangerous for young people like students, particularly when it gets into social media. Being gossiped about can cause havoc for a young person. A barrage of nasty comments can lead to a deep depression and even suicide. But it seems gossip and rumor are weapons of choice for lots of teens. And on www.verywellfamily.com, Sherry Gordon writes a short article on understanding the impact of rumors and gossip on teens and why so many indulge in them. She writes, "Drama. It happens so frequently during the teenage years that some people have come to accept it as a normal part of teenage life. But when that drama involves toxic friendships, slut-shaming and spreading rumors, that is anything but normal. In fact, for those who are impacted, gossip can be downright painful and almost impossible to ignore, especially if social media is being used to spread it. Consequently, kids who are being gossiped about are negatively impacted. For instance, gossip and rumors can destroy a person's self-confidence and affect their self-esteem. It can also lead to depression, suicidal thoughts, eating disorders, anxiety, and a host of other issues. What's more, gossip and rumors can alienate friends, ruin reputations, and even lead to ostracizing behavior and other forms of relational aggression. She goes on to discuss the difference between rumor and gossip, saying rumor is an unverified story or bit of information that may not or may be true. Those who spread rumors mostly don't bother to find out if their words are true or not. And also, the rumor tends to change a little every time it's retold, exaggerating and altering it. Gossip is slightly different from a rumor, Sherry Gordon says. Usually, gossip involves a juicy detail of some sort, which means the information is shocking or personal. What's more, gossip is usually spread behind a person's back and can be very hurtful. Gossip usually involves love, relationships, sex, and other issues that people usually do not talk about publicly. Additionally, gossip almost always causes pain and a humiliation for the person it's about. People share gossip without any thought of how it might impact the person it's about. She then addresses why kids spread rumors and gossip, saying, there are a variety of reasons why kids will spread rumors or engage in gossip, but most kids gossip or spread rumors to fit in with their friends as a way to feel special or to impress others. She then lists a number of reasons why kids gossip, including to feel good about themselves. When people feel bad about themselves, they sometimes will target other people to try to make themselves feel better, she says. As a result, they talk about others as a way to deflect attention from themselves. Another reason to feel accepted, she continues, if everyone else in their circle of friends is gossiping or spreading rumors, kids feel like they have to do the same thing in order to be accepted. Many times, peer pressure will play a factor in spreading rumors or gossiping. And then there is attention seeking. When teens know a secret that nobody else knows, she says, or they are the first person in the group to hear a rumor, it makes them the center of attention. As a result, kids that are trying to fit in or climb the social ladder might use gossip and rumors as a tool to gain popularity. Other kids may be looking for power. Says Gordon, some teens want to be in control and at the top of the social ladder. When kids are at the top of the social ladder or are determined to climb higher, they sometimes accomplish that by diminishing the status of another person. Spreading rumors or gossiping is one of the primary ways people, especially mean girls, jockey for social status. Some want revenge. When teens are envious of another person's looks, popularity, or money, they might use gossip and rumors to hurt that person. They also tend to use gossip and rumors to get back at someone who they feel deserves to be hurt. Making up a rumor or spreading gossip sometimes satisfies their need for revenge. And finally, gossip is a way of relieving boredom. Research indicates that boredom is often the number one reason why teens spread rumors, claims Gordon. These teens are bored with their lives because there's no drama. As a result, they resort to rumors and gossip to spice things up and make life more exciting. She finishes by suggesting parents find a way to address the gossiping and rumor that is comfortable for the child, like not dwelling on what other people say or confronting the gossiper. Now, this whole discussion about gossip came out of Pema Chodron's commentary on the slogan, "Don't Malign Others," in which she said, "We put a lot of energy and time into gossiping about others. Perhaps there's somebody, maybe just one person, that you have a problem with. Maybe it's Pearl, who's so pitiful. She's always feeling left out, and you find yourself reminded of your mother, who's also like that. Somehow Pearl and your mother become all mixed up together, and you find yourself continually irritated and disgusted by the pitifulness of Pearl, and it keeps triggering a lot of stuff in you. Yet you don't have the slightest interest in actually getting to know Pearl and finding out what's going on there. You have no desire to communicate with Pearl and find out who she is. Instead, there's some kind of satisfaction that you get from not liking her, and you spend a lot of time and energy talking to yourself about pitiful Pearl, or whoever it might be, horrible Horatio, or miserable Mortimer." Now, other commentators on this slogan have come from slightly different angles. For instance, Jamion Contrell and The Great Path of Awakening, translated by Ken MacLeod, parses the slogan as, "Don't be excited by cutting remarks," and says, "In general, don't take joy in disparaging others. In particular, when any person says something bad about you, don't respond by talking maliciously about him to others. In fact, even if some injury has resulted, strive always to praise the good qualities of others without blaming this or that person." And B. Alan Wallace, in his commentary, The 7-Point Mind Training, translates the slogan as, "Do not laugh at malicious jokes." He writes, "The commentary here says more than the verse itself. Do not make bad jokes. The author is not advising us to avoid bad puns, but is referring to malicious sarcasm. Don't make fun of other people in ways that would bring pain in their hearts. The temptation is especially strong when it entails the double satisfaction of disparaging another person and exalting ourselves at the same time by showing off our cleverness. Those of us prone to this type of humor need to address this by changing the conditioning of our speech. All types of harsh speech should be abandoned to avoid harming ourselves and others as well." In Enlightened Courage, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche translates the slogan as, "Do not meet abuse with abuse," and says, "If people say to us, 'You are not a good practitioner, your vows are useless,' we should not respond by pointing out their defects. For instance, telling a blind man that he's blind, or a lame man that he's a cripple. If we act like this, then both parties will be angry. Therefore, let us not utter a word that will harm or make others unhappy. When things are not going well, we should not blame anyone else." Now, although meant for a business audience, some pointers in the Harvard Business Review on how to react to criticism could be relevant to us here. Dory Clark is a marketing strategist and professional speaker who teaches at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. She is the author of Entrepreneurial You, Reinventing You, and Stand Out. She was interviewed on a national radio program and afterwards received some generally favorable feedback from colleagues and friends. However, one email from a woman she had known in college said she had failed and called her reprehensible. Says Clark, "She interpreted my commentary about search engine optimization techniques as aiding and abetting a politician she had disagreed with. The woman asked Clark to remove her name from her database and wanted to have nothing to do with Clark in the future." Clark gives four good options for us to consider when we find ourselves in a similar type of situation. First of all, she echoes Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche in saying, "Don't immediately reply to criticism with indignation and tit-for-tat criticism." As Clark puts it, "Don't mouth off," and says, "It would have been easy for me to snap back at my old acquaintance. After all, I hadn't even seen her in nearly a decade, and here she was lecturing me. But instead, I waited to cool off and wrote her a cordial note back saying I'd be glad to take her off any lists. In the internet era, you don't want to leave any angry paper trail that others can post online, ever." And that's a good point, that last one. Once something is on the internet, it is there for the length of your lifetime at least, and who knows when it may be a fang that comes back to bite you in the future. Clark's next piece of advice is to take time out to see if we are overreacting. It is so easy to take things personally when they're not at all, or to misinterpret someone's comments. Clark quotes a friend who saw a quote of the friend's on some blog post and thought it was taken out of context and was insulting. She was about to post a long diatribe against the blogger, but Clark stopped her and made her rethink. She did, and toned down her comments, and shortly afterwards received a friendly and appreciative reply from the blogger, who had no intention of insulting her at all. So, think back on your experience. How many times have you been certain of somebody's intention, only to find out later that it was nowhere near what you imagined? When we build our reactions on mere perceptions and conditioned mental constructs, we are bound to make mistakes and cause all kinds of grief, both for ourselves and those we're interacting with. Now, we'll say a little bit more about this later. But Clark's next point is to remember that criticism can be a sign of success. When people are criticizing or bad-mouthing us, it shows we are making an impact. And although it can and perhaps should cause us to question ourselves, we often cannot succeed without making somebody else feel uncomfortable. And also, even though a critic may be showing us something about ourselves or taking us down, sometimes it's just a way of making themselves visible. Clark writes, "I used to work in politics, and one of the established rules was to attack upwards, which is why candidates with low name recognition are always challenging incumbents to debates, and the incumbents usually ignore them." And finally, Dorrie Clark reminds us that karma, if not instant, bites back sooner or later. She says, "Zen masters and self-help gurus have long counseled that we should forgive those who attacked us. Holding a grudge only serves to tie us to that person and the negative memory they engender." "I agree, up to a point," she says. "But one of the great pleasures in my business life has been the opportunity to demonstrate that people eventually get what they deserve. That doesn't mean seeking out vengeance, but it does mean that corporate circles are small and interconnected, and eventually you may be called upon as a reference. Should he get that training position? Should she be hired for that non-profit? Should we make him state director? And when asked by a trusted colleague, it's a pleasure to give a very frank answer." We all tend to move in fairly small circles, and the same can be said for all of us. If we criticize someone in our circle, it reverberates, and in due course, the result will come back to haunt us. Of course, we should never take pleasure in another's ill fortune or harm another. But often, we don't have to return bad-mouthing with bad-mouthing. The original bad-mouthing can be a punishment in itself. And if we keep our minds anchored in loving kindness and compassion through everything, at least one person in the confrontation will not only remain relatively happy at the time of the criticism, but will be training the mind to be peaceful and kind in all situations in the long term. And now, just to return to the point of misreading others' intentions, www.theatlantic.com has some research on why we are so often wrong about what others are trying to convey to us. The article is titled "Mixed Signals: Why People Misunderstand Each Other," and it is written by Emily Isfahani Smith, the author of The Power of Meaning: Crafting a Life That Matters. She's also a columnist for the New Criterion and an editor at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, where she manages a self-improvement endeavor, the Ben Franklin Circles Project. She starts the article with a story from Heidi Grant Halvorsen's book, No One Understands You and What to Do About It. Halvorsen has a friend, Tim, who, when taking on a new job as a manager, made one of his priorities showing his team he valued each one's input. So, at team meetings, he would use his active listening face whenever someone had something to say about the work. Halvorsen writes, "After a few weeks of meetings, one team member finally summoned up the courage to ask him the question that had been on everyone's mind. That question was, 'Tim, are you angry with us right now?' When Tim explained that he wasn't at all angry, that he was just putting on his active listening face, his colleague gently explained that his active listening face looked a lot like his angry face." Smith writes, "To Halvorsen, a social psychologist at Columbia Business School who has extensively researched how people perceive one another, Tim's story captures one of the primary problems of being a human being. Try though you might to come across in a certain way to others, people often perceive you in an altogether different way. One person may think, for example, that by offering help to a colleague, she's coming across as generous. But her colleague may interpret her offer as a lack of faith in his abilities. Just as he misunderstands her, she misunderstands him. She offered him help because she thought he was overworked and stressed. He has, after all, been showing up early to work and going home late every day. But that's not why he's keeping strange hours. He just works best when the office is less crowded. Smith points out that this happens not only at work, but also in the rest of our lives. She writes, "Most of the time, Halvorsen says, people don't realize they're not coming across the way they think they are. If I ask you, Halvorsen told me, about how you see yourself, what traits you would say describe you, and I ask someone who knows you well to list your traits, the correlation between what you say and what your friend says will be somewhere between 0.2 and 0.5. There's a big gap between how other people see us and how we see ourselves." Halvorsen says the misreadings come from some quirks of human psychology. Writes Smith, "First, most people suffer from what psychologists call the transparency illusion, the belief that what they feel, desire, and intend is crystal clear to others, even though they've done very little to communicate clearly what is going on inside their minds. Because of this, people don't make the effort to be clear about intentions and emotional states as they could be, so it's easy to misread them. Chances are," Halvorsen writes, "how you look when you're slightly frustrated isn't all that different from how you look when you're a little bit concerned, confused, disappointed, or nervous. Your 'I'm kind of hurt by what you just said' face probably looks an awful lot like your 'I'm not at all hurt by what you just said' face. And the majority of times that you've said to yourself, 'I made my intentions clear,' or 'He knows what I meant,' you didn't, and he doesn't. In the meantime, the perception of the person we are communicating with is under the influence of two other psychological forces. Smith says, first, according to a large body of psychological research, individuals are what psychologists call cognitive misers. That is, people are lazy thinkers. She quotes Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, in which he holds that our minds processes information, including information about others, in two ways, which he calls System 1 and System 2. They are metaphors for two kinds of reasoning. Smith says, System 1 processes information quickly, intuitively, and automatically. System 1 is at work, as Halvorsen notes in her book, when individuals engage in effortless thinking, like when they do simple maths problems like 3 plus 3 equals 6, or when they drive on familiar roads as they talk to a friend in the car, or when they see someone smile and immediately know that that person is happy. In social perception, System 1 uses many shortcuts when it reads others' facial expressions, body language, and intentions. And one of the most powerful shortcuts is the primacy effect. This explains why first impressions are so important. And according to this effect, the information one learns about another in their early encounters very strongly decides how that person will see the other ever afterwards. An example of this, Halvorsen points out, is that in research on this effect, children who perform better on the first half of a math test and worse on the second half might be judged to be smarter than those who perform less well on the first part of the test but better on the second part. Two students might have performed objectively the same, but one benefits from the primacy effect bias. The implications of finding like these for late bloomers, Halvorsen writes, or anyone who struggles initially only to excel later, are terrifying. Smith writes that Kahneman's System 2 processes information in a conscious, rational, and deliberative manner. For instance, it is at play when we do complicated math problems like algebra, or when trying to figure out what our boss intends when leaving us a cryptic note saying, "Call me immediately." Says Smith, unlike System 1, where thinking is automatic and effortless, System 2 thinking is effortful. However, System 2 can correct System 1. For instance, if overriding evidence that the first impression from System 1, that Johnny is bad at math, says that impression needs to be updated, Johnny is scoring consistently well on his other math tests, then the perceiver can engage in System 2 thinking to update his impression. But System 2 demands a lot of effort and mental energy. Salveson says people have to be really motivated to engage in System 2 thinking. For example, the teacher might only re-evaluate Johnny's performance after Johnny or his parents complain that he's not being graded fairly, or if he suddenly and unexpectedly emerges as the star of the class. Halverson points out that because most of us are cognitive misers, trading speed for accuracy in thinking about others, perception usually ends with System 1. These two systems of reasoning lead individuals to perceive others in two distinct stages, a fast but flawed stage and a reflective and deliberative stage. One study by the psychologist Dan Gilbert of Harvard University and his colleagues sheds light on how perception occurs in two phases. Participants came into a lab and watched 7 video clips of a woman speaking to a stranger. In 5 of the clips, the woman appeared to be stressed out and anxious. Though the video was silent, there were subtitles indicating the topics that the woman and the stranger were talking about. In one condition, participants were told that the woman and stranger were talking about neutral topics for all clips. In the other, they were told that in the 5 clips in which the woman appeared anxious, she was talking about touchy subjects like sexual fantasies, personal secrets, and life failures. Gilbert also asked some of the participants to memorize the discussion topics that appeared in the subtitles to keep them mentally busy so that they couldn't enter the second phase of perception, Kahneman's System 2. At the end of the experiment, the participants were asked whether or not this woman was an anxious person. The participants, not distracted by the memorization task, rated her as expected. They thought she was anxious when discussing neutral topics and acting stressed out, and not anxious when she was discussing stressful topics and acting stressed out. They were able to enter the second phase of perception by taking the woman's situation into account. Anyone asked by her sexual fantasies would likely feel uncomfortable. But those who were kept mentally busy came to a very different conclusion. Regardless of what situation she was in, they concluded that she was indeed an anxious person. For these people, acting anxious equaled being anxious. And there we have some research into why we misjudge others so easily. Perhaps we should slow down and engage System 2 type thinking much more often. We can talk more about this next time, but now our time is up and we must say farewell. Please dedicate any positive potential from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Thank you, and goodbye.